Hey everybody, it's Britt, lead pastor at Sunridge. Welcome back to our teaching podcast. You know, we are on a mission here at Sunridge to help people find and follow Jesus. We believe in the good news that Jesus welcomes all, regardless of how far you feel from God. That means we're a great starting point to explore Christianity or to sink your spiritual roots deep as a devoted Jesus follower. If you'd like to know more about us, just check out our website at sunridgechurch.org. And of course, we'd love to have you drop in anytime for a visit to learn and worship along with us. And now, here's our teaching for this week.
Well, good morning, everybody. So good to see you guys. Welcome to Sunridge Sunday morning service. If you're new here, you don't recognize me, my name's Britt. I serve here as the lead pastor, and we're so glad that you came to worship with us today. We're turning a page in our study of Ezra and Nehemiah. We're jumping into the book of Nehemiah. These two books are connected. But first of all, I want to read you something from the opening of a book that I recently read. It's titled, How the Church Fails Business People and What Can Be Done About It. John Knapp writes this. I'm going to put it up on the screen. Here's a little thought experiment. What comes to mind first when you hear the word business? This morning's financial headlines, your bank balance. If your daily work is in business, you may think of experiences and relationships that define much of your life. Now consider another word, he says, faith. What images emerge? It's likely that your mind turned in another direction toward God, prayer, family, and church. He then goes on to demonstrate how the majority of Christians tend to divide their world into the secular and the sacred. In other words, I have my secular world. That involves my work, productivity, meetings, ambition, competition. And then I have my faith world, which involves God and church, prayer, the Bible, etc. It's like our faith is walled off from what we spend most of our time doing. Maybe it trickles a little into our family life, but little else. Now, so that we're all on the same page, I'm not talking about laying a huge King James Bible on your desk at work, or even putting up Bible memes in your cubicle. I'm not even talking about having a moment of prayer when you go to lunch with your coworkers. I'm talking about faith being integrated into every part of our life, into everything that we do, and that our work or our vocation is not an entity or an activity that's separate from our expression of faith. So let me ask you guys a question. What do you spend the majority of your hours each week doing? Now just think about that for a second. This is going to be a group participation. If you can boil it down to one or two words, that'd be great. But you ready? I want you to say the thing that you do most during the week, all at once. Ready? Go. Boy, you guys sounded depressed about that, I gotta say. You might have said plumber or teacher or coach, or carpenter. You're in the military. Maybe you spend most of your week chasing preschool kids around the house or brewing coffee or driving kids to practice or selling software or volunteering somewhere. So have you ever thought of those activities as a meaningful expression of your faith? That the time that you spent doing those things was actually something spent as purposeful in the kingdom of God. So today, what we're going to see as we turn the page to Nehemiah is we're going to find a great example of someone who was not in the religious business, but he made a huge difference in the life of a city. And what he did was just everyday practical stuff, and it bettered a city's well-being. And we're going to see today that the work that we do, whether it's paid or unpaid, is actually an expression of our faith. We've been in the study of Ezra and Nehemiah, two distinct books in our English Bibles, one book in the Hebrew, and they tell us about the Jewish exiles' return to Jerusalem. And they are the last narrative that we have of the Jewish people until we get to the New Testament. Remember that Israel was conquered by Babylon and taken into captivity. And the majority of the citizens were carted off to Babylon, just as the prophet Jeremiah had predicted. But also, just as he prophesied, they returned to Judah 70 years later. And thus far, we've seen two people that have made a huge impact in that return. We read about Zerubbabel, and he restored the temple, if you remember. He was a public administrator, so that was not a religious job. He wasn't in the religious business. But then there was Ezra, who reestablished the traditions of their faith. And he was a priest, so he comes from a religious vocation. And today we're going to meet Nehemiah. He's a devout believer, but he's not a priest like Ezra or in any religious vocation. Nehemiah was a cupbearer to Artaxerxes. Here's what Merrill Unger says about this role in Unger's Bible Dictionary. The cupbearer was often chosen for his personal beauty and attractions, and in ancient Oriental courts was always a person of rank and importance. From the confidential nature of his duties and his frequent access to the royal presence, he possessed great influence. Now, if you're not familiar, this cupbearer would taste the wine and the food as it came into the king's presence. And that's where the title of the position comes from. He bore the cup for the king. And you might think, what an awesome job. But the cupbearer's role was to prevent the assassination of the king. That's why he's tasting the wine and the food. And he was especially focused on preventing any poisoning attempt of the wine. Now, every time I read that or mention it, I can't help but think of that scene in Princess Bride, where Wesley gets into a battle of wits. Never get into a battle of wits with Cecilian when death is on the line, right? Thank you, the three of you that have watched Princess Bride. The king and his cupbearer would spend a significant amount of time together, at least every meal, so obviously there's a great deal of trust that goes on between these two people. And we'll see that they both, the king and Nehemiah, have great respect for one another. And that's huge, considering the fact that Artaxerxes is part of the oppressive system that Nehemiah's people are under at this time. So today what we're going to do is we're just jumping into the book, and we're going to introduce Nehemiah to you guys and how he comes to be part of the return of the exiles to Jerusalem. And then, as always, we're going to kind of wrap up and draw out a few observations that we can take home for us today. But first, let's take an overview of chapter 1, beginning in verse 1, and we're going to go all the way through chapter 2, verse 10. So you can either have your Bible open on your device, or if you have a hard Bible, and I'll put the pertinent scriptures up on the screen as well. This book opens with Nehemiah's brother coming to visit Nehemiah from Jerusalem, where the exiles have been repopulated. And Nehemiah, at this time, lives in the palace of the Persian capital. He's 800 miles away from Jerusalem. And he asks his brother about the situation there and how the people are doing. So he's interested in how his countrymen are doing, how they're faring. And Nehemiah's brother, Hanani, tells him in verse 3, those who survived the exile and are back in the province are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates have been burned with fire. When Nehemiah hears this, he's devastated by the news. Verse 4, when I heard these things, I sat down and wept. For some days I mourned and fasted and prayed before the God of heaven. So let me give some context here. The temple is rebuilt. The people, they're practicing Judaism. And they're worshiping God. But the city is vulnerable. Its walls are broken down. And the proud Jewish people are disgraced in their sacred city. And they're being criticized and slandered and threatened by the surrounding people. And Nehemiah, he's burdened by this. His heart is with these people, even though his body isn't there. Even though he's on this great career track right now, we would call him a high-level executive today. His heart, he has a heart for the things of God and for God's people. You know, when I say that, even when I read this, it makes me think of Sunridge. of people who have jobs, who have businesses to run, and families to care for. You know, I wasn't always a pastor. Have I ever mentioned that to you guys before? I remember what it was like to have a demanding job and yet love this church and to care about its welfare and to serve its body. So I want to say, God bless all of you who have careers, yet you carry a burden for God's work through this thing called Sunridge, and you love God's people. So when Nehemiah hears about this, what does he do? It says he prays. Now remember, he's not a priest, he's not a pastor, he's not in Christian ministry, but he prays. And in chapter 1, verses 5 through 11, we have his prayer. And he asks God to please hear him out. In verse 6, he says, "Let your ear be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you night and day for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you. We have acted very wickedly towards you. We have not obeyed the commands, decrees, and laws you gave your servant Moses." So Nehemiah here in his prayer acknowledges the effect of sin and how it impacts the human living condition. And you can also see or hear his compassion for the people. Verse 10, "They are your servants and your people, whom you redeemed by your great strength and your mighty hand. Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name." Then you can see in this prayer that obviously something is stirring in his heart. He says, "Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man." Now, if you just knew that part, you wouldn't know who this man is, or yet what Nehemiah has in his mind, but we're about to see it. And here's Nehemiah's request in Nehemiah 2, verses 1 through 10. Now remember, his prayer indicated that he was about to act on something that very day. But this is 4 months later. He brings the king his wine, as Megan read earlier, and in verse 1 of chapter 2, in the month of Nisan, the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was brought for him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had not been sad in his presence before. And what the scene, what it appears is happening is that Nehemiah's been praying and he's been fasting and waiting for this opportunity to discuss with the king this thing that's on his heart, but he's never showed his distress in front of the king before. But today it's getting the best of him, and the king picks up on it in verse 2. So the king asked me, "Why does your face look so sad when you are not ill? This can be nothing but sadness of heart." And then Nehemiah says, "I was very much afraid." He's afraid because as one employed by the king, he's not allowed to have a downer day. You don't bring your problems to work when you work for the king. The king has plenty of his own already. And raining on the king's parade could be punishable by death. Keep that in mind when you see the boldness of Nehemiah here in verse 3. "But I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my ancestors are buried lies in ruins and the gates have been destroyed by fire?" You can tell here by by Artaxerxes' response, he has great respect for Nehemiah, who's a person like of this faith that he doesn't understand, that just he's an employee that he has great respect for. So it says something about the way Nehemiah conducted his career with Artaxerxes. And the king said to me, verse 4, "What is it you want?" And then Nehemiah says, "Then I prayed to the God of heaven." So, summary, the king responds positively here to what Nehemiah is bringing out. He's listening carefully. And then Nehemiah throws this quick prayer up before he answers. I don't think he fell on his knees, you know, in front of the king, but in his heart, I think he thought it. He probably prayed, "Okay, here we go, Lord. Maybe some of you, have you ever done that? Have you ever like been in a situation where before you answered, before you acted, before you decided, you threw up this quick prayer? After sending up that prayer, he answers the king in verse 5. He says, if it pleases the king and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city in Judah where my ancestors are buried so that I can rebuild it. Boom. He just lays it all out at once. And if, you know, Artaxerxes here, he's not a no or a yes. He wants more detail in verse 6. The king with the queen sitting beside him asked me, how long will your journey take and when will you get back? You know, the king here could have said, oh, heck no. Are you out of your mind? There's a snowball's chance that you're getting out of here to go do this. And then after he answers, Nehemiah's like, so you're saying I got a chance? And you just notice here that the queen's presence is mentioned here. So I'm thinking she has something to do with the king's positive response. You know, I don't know. Maybe she put her hand on his leg and whispered to him, now, Artie, you know that Nehemiah is a good man. You need to hear him out. Or maybe she kicked him under the throne. And then you can see here that Nehemiah just didn't have a prayer. He had a plan. And it says, it pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. Nehemiah's thought this all out. He knows when he can go. He knows how long it's going to take, and he knows what it will take. He knows what he needs. In verse 7, he said, I also said to him, he doesn't just say, okay, he's rolling out his whole plan. If it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates so that they will provide me safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the royal park, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city wall and for the residence I will occupy. You guys, he's been thinking about this for a long time. He says, okay, if I go, here's what I need. I need letters that would give me diplomatic immunity as I travel. Maybe you heard about all the red tape that Zerubbabel got tied up in. And he said, and I need building materials. And then there's this, both he reveals the outcome and his perspective of it. He says, and because the gracious hand of God was upon me, the king granted my requests. There's our key phrase that we've been mentioning. If you're just joining us, this phrase, God's hand was upon me or God's hand was upon them, appears 9 times between the two books. So what we see here is Nehemiah's earned the respect of the king. He's been shrewd in his approach. He's prayed and he's planned. And now it's happening. And he can see God's hand on his life. You know, the next thing we know, he arrives in Jerusalem ready to rebuild the walls. And that's where we're going to leave off today. Chapter 2, verse 10. So I know some of you are sitting there and you're saying, like, so what in the world does a guy who provided security for a king so long ago have to do with me living in the Temecula Valley today? That's a big question, right? Or maybe some of you along the way, you've been making personal connections for yourself. There's a few I can see. To start with, first of all, let's go back to the beginning of my talk today, where I discussed this false separation between the secular and the sacred. I want you to see how important Nehemiah is to the return of the exiles, for the city of Jerusalem to thrive. He's not a priest. He's not a pastor. He's not in religious employment at all. In fact, only one of the three big impact leaders in their return is in religious vocation. Nehemiah is a believer whose vocation isn't at the church or in missions or some other ministry. And I think that pretty much describes most of us in this room or those that are watching online right now, right? So that means that all of us should be able to find something to relate to here. So as we look at Nehemiah's role in this return today and throughout, what I want you to do is I want you to apply what we're saying to your personal situation, where you are right now, what you do. And I want you to see that Nehemiah is not in the religion industry, but he's a believer, and he loves God, and he loves his people. He's just an ordinary person living an ordinary life, but he has the hand of God upon him. He has ordinary but practical skills that God is going to use to accomplish his purposes. It's not going to be Ezra the priest that does this. It's going to be Nehemiah, the cupbearer. Nehemiah saw something in his situation that most of us don't see in the moment. And it's this: the gracious hand of God was upon him. That statement can be true of all of us in this building, or of those of you that are watching online. You don't have to be in Christian ministry for it to be true. So what did that mean? What did it mean that Nehemiah was not in religious vocation, but the hand of God was on his life? That's what I want to wrap up our thoughts with today, and I have four things that I think are evidence of God's hand on Nehemiah, and I want us to draw application to our lives today. First of all, he was interested in spiritual matters. He was interested in spiritual matters. He was the one who inquired of his brother how things were going in Jerusalem. And even though he wasn't religiously employed, he carried this burden for God's work and for his people. He cared enough to ask. He cared enough to weep. He cared enough to pray. And he cared enough to act. Nehemiah reminds me of someone else who worked in the non-religious sphere in your Bible, yet had a heart for spiritual things. He was also a governmental leader. He was a king, in fact, David. And he is described as a man after my own heart, Acts 13. Nehemiah, not a priest or a scholar, but he's interested in spiritual things. And if we read into, if we peer into what the way he talks to the king, he has a solid knowledge of Scripture. He knows the biblical narratives. He quotes God and his promise to Moses. He makes a living protecting the king and does it well, but he also cares about God's work and his people. I can't even begin to tell you guys how important those of you who are in business are to this church. You have skills and knowledge that no one can teach you. They don't teach in seminary. You know how things work, and you know how to get things done. And I am so grateful for all of our volunteers at Sunridge who pray and give. You're working jobs, some very demanding of your time and your energy. You're raising families. Kids are running all around. You're running them around. They're playing their sports, and you're taking them to music lessons. And yet a big part of your heart is in what God is doing in this church and in other ministries. And because you've given God an open invitation to use you, God has given you a burden for what needs to be done. And your interest in spiritual things are evidence of God's hand upon you. Another evidence of God's hand upon Nehemiah was his humble desire to heal and not harm. His humble desire to heal and not harm. When Nehemiah heard of the decay in Jerusalem, he saw the city's condition as a product of the sinful human condition. Greed and self-interest, laziness, harassment, oppression. Yet he didn't wag his finger at those bad people. Look what's going on over there. These people can't even run their city. Must be run by a Democrat or a Republican. Depends on your vantage point, right? In fact, he takes personal responsibility for what's happening. In his prayer, he said, "Let your ear, Nehemiah 1:6, be attentive and your eyes open to hear the prayer your servant is praying before you day and night for your servants, the people of Israel. I confess the sins we Israelites, including myself and my father's family, have committed against you." Nehemiah had the insight that only humility can provide, that we're all sinners. He He didn't personally cause these deplorable conditions in Jerusalem, but yet he accepts part of the responsibility as another human being. He doesn't sugarcoat what's going on there by pretending it doesn't exist or like make it into something that it's not, but he explicitly says this is the result of sin. But his confession of that is absent of the smug arrogance and defensiveness that comes with self-righteousness. You see, God doesn't use prideful finger pointers. He doesn't use prideful finger pointers. Jesus once made an observation to his disciples in Luke 18:10. He recalls that two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and one a tax collector. And the Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, "God, I thank you that I'm not like all these other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all that I get." But then in verse 13, the tax collector stood at a distance, which I understand since the Pharisee's pointing at him. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." You know, I believe that an evidence of God's hand upon us is our ability to take responsibility for our own cultural context. There are a lot of systemic problems in the world today that we're all facing. And they're not just their problems, they're our problems. Poverty, homelessness, racism, economic inequality, divorce, abortion, war. These are all symptomatic of the sinful condition of all of us. The world is broken because it's filled with broken people. And I'm one of them. And so are you. That realization can keep us anchored in humility. That positions us for God's hand to be upon us to make a difference. The question is, do we want to make a point or do we want to make a difference? Part of our vision here at Sunridge, we say, you know, deepen faith, bring hope, live love. It's like, bring hope. Our vision is that when we see problems, we want to bring hope to those problems. We bring the gospel. We bring our hands and our feet. We bring money. We bring resources. We bring help. We don't point our finger and say, "Well, they screwed it up. They should live with it." We bring hope. And that we do that because we're grounded in humility, realizing that, but for the grace of God, there go I. So having a humble desire to heal and not harm is evidence of God's hand upon you. Thirdly, Nehemiah was a man of prayer and planning. Prayer and planning. Nehemiah is an ordinary guy looking to gain permission from his boss to improve his beloved city in very practical ways. Yet everything he does is a matter of prayer. He even prayed in that moment, right? God's hand is on him because he has confidence in God. That's why he prays. But there's another way to see his reliance upon God, and it's in his planning. You say, that seems to me to be like the opposite of faith. You know, isn't planning and organizing an evidence of lack of faith? Not at all. One of my good buddies that I did ministry with, I grew up, we became Christians about the same time. He was a very spiritual guy. Love him. He's since gone on to be with the Lord. But he used to dog me all the time for being so practical and for planning. And so we would get together to do something, say, "Okay, you know, let's plan this out." It's like, "Oh yeah, here goes the planning, you know." And I'm like, "Dude, that's what we're supposed to do." So I let him handle the prayer. I did the planning. That worked out good as a team. Nehemiah's faith was so great that he prepared his plan before he was even given permission to go. That's how far ahead of it he was. When the king responded with questions of how long's the journey, when will you be back, Nehemiah had an answer right there. He's able to give the king a specific timeline. He knows exactly what authorization he's going to need. And he's already prepared a materials list he'll need for the job. Nehemiah has been praying and he's been planning. So what if Nehemiah never prayed? Maybe the king's heart would never be turned toward him and be moved for the project. And what if he had never planned? Then he might have missed his opportunity, right? How embarrassing would it have been for Nehemiah to make this big deal and the king say, okay, well, let's do something about that. It's like, okay, I got to get back to you soon. I got to think about that. He shows the king immediately he's ready to go. You know, Jesus reasoned with his disciples once in Luke 14:28. He said, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Won't you first sit down and estimate the cost to see if you have enough money to complete it? For if you lay the foundation and are not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule you, saying, this person began to build and wasn't able to finish. So prayer and planning are part of the faith life, whether you're building a wall, a business, a career, a church, or a family. If you want God's hand upon you, then pray like it all depends upon God and plan like it all depends upon you. Last, he saw his vocation as a holy calling. Nehemiah saw his vocation as a holy calling. What did a day in the life of Nehemiah look like? He had goals he needed to accomplish. He had to relate to a touchy boss who wasn't a believer. He had to assure the king's safety. He made tons of executive decisions. He faced obstacles and discouragement. He had to deal with constant HR issues. He managed huge projects. Not a single religious activity in the mix. But for him, it was all spiritual. He saw God's hand upon his life in these everyday endeavors. The Apostle Paul wrote in Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not men. That's what Nehemiah did here. In his prayer, he said, Nehemiah 1:11, Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man. Nehemiah calls himself God's servant. Even though his work wasn't spiritual in the direct sense, yet it became so because of the motivation of his heart. And in that, his work was holy. I'm going to ask the band to come up. I want to ask you guys as they come up, what is it that you spend the majority of your week doing? You shouted it out at the beginning, and you sounded very depressed about it. Maybe you spend most of your life in the mom life, right? Chasing little kids around, trying to teach them their colors, feed them peanut butter jelly sandwiches, and then picking up after them over and over and over and over and over and over again. Some of you are in the dad life, working, coming home, coaching, driving kids here, working in the lawn, fixing the stuff that got broke while mom and the kids were home all day, if they were home, picking kids up from preschool. Some of you, you work in a warehouse all week, and you're moving product. Some of you are plumbers. You're solving big problems for people so that their house will run. Some of you sell widgets. You sell something. You make stuff. You work in manufacturing. I could just go on and on, right? Some of you are in the military, public safety. You counsel people. You're a musician. Do you see that work? Do you see what you're doing? Do you view yourself as a servant of God? Do you see yourself as God's servant in that work? If you want to see God's hand on your life and what you do, then number one, you have to see the spiritual impact of what you do. not do something spiritual in what you do. See the actual spiritual impact of what you do, of how you make the world better and what your job is. And then if you want God's hand upon you, humbly look for ways to help others. In your career, there's something that you do that helps other people. And remember that you, in a sense, you're bringing God's kingdom to earth by what you do. You're causing human beings to flourish. You're making their lives better and their kids' lives better and the future better. If you want God's hand on your life, then pray and plan. Do them both with as much rigor and discipline and energy. And if you want God's hand upon your life, begin seeing what you do as God's calling upon you. That this is not a distraction so that you can go and do the God work. This is what God has given you to do. And as I said, you might be making the city better. You might be making someone's life better. But it's God's calling upon you. And then last, long in your heart and in your prayers and in your spirit to see God's hand upon your life, to look for it, to anticipate it, to pray about it, and to ask God. And in the endeavor that you spend your most of your waking hours doing, even if it seems like the most monotonous thing, even if it seems like super important in that moment, whatever it is that you're called to do, long to see God's hand working in your life. You know, some of you are here today and maybe you're new to church. You're trying to figure, what's the Bible all about? What is this God stuff about? What is Jesus about? The word the Bible uses to describe what Christ did is gospel. It means good news. And the good news is that Jesus Christ came because he loves every one of us. He went to the cross to demonstrate to humanity how much God cares. He was God's representative. He was God in a body. And he showed us what God would look like as a human being. And part of what he did, besides healing and ministering to people and caring about them and like training people to spread the good news, is he gave his life. He emptied himself of who he was. That was God's hand upon him. That was God's calling on him to demonstrate to the world who God is and how much he cares about human beings. And if you've never been like just stopped in that reality, I want you to think about that. If you're new to Christianity, you're new to church, I want you to think through a different lens of God came to make everybody be punished. God came in a body to love people. We're broken. We need to admit that. The Bible calls it repentance, but God came to save human beings. That's how much he cares about people. That was his purpose. And each of us who have Christ in our hearts, who want God's hand upon us, can see what we do through the lens of God is working through us. He's bringing his kingdom to this earth, and he's making the world better. He's bringing heaven to earth, which is what Jesus told the disciples to pray about, right? Your kingdom on earth as it is in heaven. That's what we're doing. We have a holy calling. Let's stand and worship together.
Hey everybody, it's Britt again. Thanks for listening. If you need something, if you have a question, or you'd just like us to pray for you, you can reach us through email, info@sunridgechurch.org. We hope you'll listen in again next week, but in the meantime, keep helping people find and follow Jesus.